From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In November of 2001, Katie Butler's father suffered a massive stroke. About a year later, he was outfitted with a pacemaker, a device Butler says kept his heart going, but did nothing to prevent his slide into dementia, incontinence, and helplessness. In the book she's written about the experience, she describes the battle fought over the territory of her father's body. The death of Butler's father was much different from her mother's death. That death was also imperfect, still involved pain and grief, but Butler says her mother died on her own terms. She rejected surgery and procedures that would just prolong the inevitable. As Butler puts it, her mother took back her body from her doctors. Today in the program, Katie Butler is joining us to describe another path to a good death. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the book she's written about the deaths of her parents, Katie Butler says her mother died too soon for her taste, though not her mother's. Her mother had rejected any surgeries that could have prolonged her life. She wanted to die on her own terms. As Butler puts it, she reclaimed her moral authority from a broken medical system. It was a lesson she learned from watching her husband and Katie's father die slowly. After suffering a massive stroke, her father had been outfitted with a pacemaker that kept his heart going, but could do nothing about the dementia or the incontinence. From Katie Butler's perspective, he had died too late. In her book, Butler says her father's death helped her understand the human costs of all this, but after her mother's death, she realized there could be another path. Katie Butler is joining us to talk about all of the elements that play out in this story for families throughout the world, the economic incentives, the ignorance, the fear, and what she calls the unintended consequences of medical technology's successful war on natural death. The book is called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. And Katie Butler, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, I wanted to start. Let's talk about mom and dad first, because this is a book that I think begins with the vibrancy of their lives. You write about this in the prologue. You say you don't like to describe what old age was doing to your parents without explaining how much they loved each other and the fact that you loved them. So let's start with that. Introduce us to your parents.
Well, my parents were South African immigrants to the U.S. They were full of zest and life and intelligence. My father lost his arm in the Second World War, and yet he went on to earn a PhD from Oxford, to build floor-to-ceiling bookcases for our living room, to coach rugby, and to sail with my two brothers as crew on Long Island Sound. So a very gutsy person who didn't give up easily on anything. And my mother, too, was very much a greatest generation woman. Mm. She could sew a silk blouse from scratch, and she could also stain her own deck. This is up into her 80s. She was staining her own deck. So very self-reliant, frugal, intelligent, fun-loving, and in some ways very elegant people.
Yeah. And you sort of walk us through early on in the book the bones of the story of your parents' death, which this all begins, and I want to sort of start there. This is November of 2001. Your father is 79, yeah, and he suffers this devastating stroke. And really that was obviously crucial, but it seems like the real clincher for the story comes a year later when, in what you describe as this moment of hurry and hope, as you put it, he's outfitted with a pacemaker.
Right. Well, the moment I lived in California, my parents lived in Connecticut. And the moment I got that phone call from my mother saying that my father had had this stroke, I just, it was like a lightning bolt goes through a family at a moment like this. Everything changes. And in some ways, I became aware at that moment of my father's mortality. It was on a gut level clear to me this wasn't going to be something he bounced back from. So a year later, He suffered a hernia. He couldn't get a cardiac clearance to fix the hernia unless he got a pacemaker because he had a slow heartbeat. Now, the slow heartbeat had not created a single problem for him. He'd had a slow heartbeat for 6 years. It had just been a problem that showed up on a test, but had no effect in real life. And unfortunately, my mother just simply listened to the cardiologist, didn't explore whether there could be other options, other ways to get him through that surgery safely, for example. And in a heartbeat, to coin a phrase, she made a decision. And I felt, even at the time, very uncomfortable with it. And so did the family doctor.
And then we come to this moment, the burden of his care. I mean, you mentioned it is, it starts to really, well, crushing. Yeah. It's crushing your mother.
Yeah. Yes. And there's like 28 million caregivers like my mother taking care of someone over 75. We give them a lot of lip service, but not really enough help. And it was absolutely crushing because he couldn't fasten a belt or finish a sentence with any ease. And I think what makes this so difficult, and so difficult for other families in the same position, is that my father was kind of in a gray zone that was slowly, slowly turning dark. So at the moment that the pacemaker came in, he was still walking down to the neighborhood pool 3 times a week by himself to do water exercises. So I think this is what makes these decisions so complex for families, because you're not only making a decision for that moment, you're making a decision that's going to play out over maybe the next 5 years. And in my father's case, the decline continued. And the stroke damage was then accompanied by dementia. And he started to go blind from macular degeneration, so he couldn't even read the paper, couldn't go to the pool. So all of his final pleasures were one by one stripped from him. And of course, the caregiving burden on my mother became worse and worse, or heavier and heavier, as his decline continued. Mm. And so finally, in those last couple of years of his life, like, I would have to coach him to take off his slippers before he put on his shoes. He couldn't do the most simple tasks. And it was a torture for him as well as for us.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a physical torture. And I sometimes get emails from someone or a message sort of like, well, your father really wasn't in physical pain, so how dare your mother presume to try to turn this pacemaker off? But he was miserable. I mean, he was probably the man, who's definitely the man I had loved most in my life, all through most of my life. And to see, you know, there's a lot of misery that doesn't show up in the form of people screaming in agony. And I don't see why we have to subject them to an artificially prolonged dying process just because they're not screaming in agony.
Well, you write about that day when your mother, I think, finally, because I think you had been longing for this question. She asks you to help get his pacemaker turned off. And you describe it as this moral choice that you say, I guess on one hand you longed for it, but you also weren't exactly prepared for it.
It was horrible. In the book I say that I both longed for it and dreaded it.
Yeah.
And that was the absolute truth. And it was just, again, like an electricity going through my body, knowing that I really had to help her, I had to participate, and my gut telling me she was right. I mean, I had been longing for it for a couple of years, thinking, this is a mistake. This was a terrible medical mistake, and it should be undone. But being put in that position of calling a cardiologist and saying, we want to try to turn this pacemaker off, will you help us, was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. I remember sitting on the couch with her and just trembling after making that phone call. I was just shaking. Mm.
This was something that there's an experience you had had earlier in your career as a reporter. You were working for the San Francisco Chronicle. This was in the 1980s.
Right.
And you had occasion to spend, I think it was several weeks, 6 weeks or something, working on in an intensive care unit.
Yes.
And you mentioned how you had seen that, you describe it as this line between saving a life on one hand and then prolonging a dying on the other hand. And it was an experience that you say you had never forgotten.
I have never forgotten it. Because obviously that intensive care unit, it was saving the lives of some young people who were going to have a chance to recover and have a really decent life again. You know, people with big medical crises or, shotgun wounds or car accidents. But then there were the people in their late 70s, in their 80s, whose lives had come to their natural end. And frankly, they were being almost tortured because having a tube shoved down your throat is actually painful. And it's so irritating that they usually have to drug people into nearly a coma state to make sure they don't tear those lines out or else tie down their hands. And this is very traumatic, not only for the person, but for the nurses and the doctors who are caring for them. They cry in the corners of the ICU sometimes because they feel they're being forced to torture someone.
You know, this question comes up a lot. People always say this because in theory it sounds right that none of us want to die plugged into a machine.
Right.
But then in reality, what have you found about whether we in fact really mean it? For ourselves or for our loved ones? Because then, there's theory and then there's reality, I guess.
3/4 of people say they want to die at home, but in fact, only 1/4 do. And I sometimes say when I'm speaking at a bookstore or something, I say, look, people will say to their friends, take me out and shoot me if I get like that.
Yeah.
But take me out and shoot me is not an end-of-life plan. And if you don't have an end-of-life plan and your family isn't on board with your end-of-life plan, you may very well be subjected to someone else's end-of-life plan. And unfortunately or not, the default response of our medical system now is to treat, treat, treat until someone says no more. So first of all, we don't plan it. We don't think about it. I think we have, maybe because we have this culture that likes to think that a power of positive thinking, you know, the secret, that if you imagine something, it's going to come true. And so perhaps we have this superstition that we shouldn't talk about it, we shouldn't think about it, which is so different from our ancestors, because our ancestors actually medically rehearsed the coming of death so that they would be prepared.
Yeah, I want to spend some time with that. There's this moment, we'll get to this also, where you write these you identify the certain stages of this process, and we'll come back to it. But one of them is this idea that you write about, that accepting that someone may not be cured is not the same as medical neglect.
Yes.
And that seems like one of the really important barriers here, is that we feel like if we're not doing everything, we're being neglectful.
It is as though the only loving thing to do is to say, do more, more, more. That's sort of the, again, we haven't really held these issues up to the light and really looked at them. Now, once my father had his stroke, it wasn't his goal, it wasn't my goal, it wasn't my mother's goal to give him all the extra years that he could possibly get. But it was our goal to keep him as independent as possible, to give him the most possible good rehab, to give him speech therapy, to do everything we could to maximize the meaning he could have out of his life at that point, and to adapt to these disabilities, which were in fact increasing. And in fact, the whole family could have used social work, you know, family therapy, to adapt to the changes that were happening to him. And I think it would be so much better if we spent more money on things like rehab and speech therapy and less money on things like very expensive devices like pacemakers and defibrillators that could cost $50,000, $100,000 to put in, and then neglect the person with these other kinds of medical needs that get bigger and bigger as the end of life approaches. So in medicine, they call it, it's terrible language, but they call it a shift in goals of care.
Yeah.
So if you're ever in a situation in a hospital where you're asking them to do something different and there's no cooperation, you need to say, I would like to have a conversation about our goals of care. I think we need a shift in goals of care. We need a shift from trying to maximize longevity. Sometimes it's to comfort care only. Sometimes it's to better rehab.
There comes this moment in your father's condition where he has He gets pneumonia, and he's finally qualified after this long, laborious process. Finally, he's qualified for hospice. Right. And so he comes finally to this hospice unit at a hospital there in Connecticut. And there's this, I have to say, really painful to read sort of mix-up where the doctors refuse to turn off his pacemaker, even though they've come to this consensus later, too late for you, that that wouldn't be, you know, assisted suicide, or it wouldn't be euthanasia to do it.
Right.
But there's a section here I wanted to have you read, and it may not be easy to read. I'm just thinking about this morning, that this may be difficult.
Yeah.
But,
thanks a lot, Doug.
Sorry. but it's this section where you mentioned that they wouldn't shut it off. Yeah. So you're left with, as you put it, 5 days of hard labor. Would you talk about this section and read it for us?
Yeah, and I must say this was one of the most painful sections of the book to write and now to read. Okay. Love can look heartless. We did not give my father oxygen or food or an IV of saline or a cup of water. If we had, we would only have slowed down the shutting down of his organs and the drawn-out process of his death. A nurse told us that dying from not eating or drinking is not painful. And I myself had fasted for days without distress. But I could not forget the Gospel of Matthew, in which Jesus says, "For I was hungry, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink." Never before in history have so many sons, daughters, and spouses been forced to treat those they love like this at the end. We would not treat a dog this way. When death takes just a few days, it is easy, or at least possible, to hold the dying person in the center of your attention. When you have already attended a slowly dying person for years, it's harder. I could barely bear to be there and listen to his labored breathing and my mother's weeping. I left my mother with him and went to Pelton's drugstore on Main Street and bought a copy of Elle magazine. I came back to the hospital and waited for my brothers to come and for my father to die. I went shopping for shoes at Marshall's, once with my mother and once alone. I came back in my new shoes and sat by his bed and read Elle and held his hand. I was 59, and I had never before been at a deathbed. Once upon a time, we knew how to die. We knew how to sit at a deathbed. We knew how to die and how to sit because we saw people we loved die all through infancy, childhood, youth, middle age, and old age. Deaths we could not make painless, deaths no machine could postpone. The deaths of our ancestors were not pretty. Some died roaring in pain. But through the centuries, we tutored ourselves in the art of dying by handing down stories about how those we loved met their deaths.
It's Katie Butler reading from her book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Katie Butler. We're talking about her book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. In it, she explores that line between saving life, as advancing medical technology is designed to do, and just also prolonging the inevitable. It's called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. In that reading, before we went to a break, you mentioned that time in the past, where we, as you said, put it, tutored ourselves in the art of dying, that this was handed down. Anciently, I wanted you to explore that, because anciently, you say in the book, we created what you call roadmaps for the deathbed. These were ars moriendi, the art of dying. It was like the script for the final moments.
Yes. It was extraordinary, the best-selling book of 1451, translated into all the different languages of Europe, was called Ars Moriendi, The Art of Dying. They even had woodcut versions for the illiterate, like little cartoons. And essentially, it laid out the, what they called them temptations to sin, which might not be our language today, but they were essentially the emotional trials of the deathbed. Things like remorse, fear of the afterlife, impatience, and not wanting to say goodbye to the things we loved and the people we loved of this world. And so these scripts were laid out, and when the dying person said X, then the people, the family members surrounding the deathbed, were instructed to say Y, or to offer a certain prayer, to reassure the person that if they repented on their deathbed, God would be all merciful and take them into heaven, to reassure them that if they were suffering remorse, to say, well, if you were to get better, wouldn't you try to straighten that out? Wouldn't you try to make that right? And so there was sort of this call and response so that people could come to some peace on their deathbed. And the most important thing was the state of mind of the dying person, because that would determine whether they went to heaven or to hell. Mm. And this idea of making the dying person the center of attention, the star of the show, the one whose state of mind matters the most, a lot of that we've lost, because when people enter a hospital, death stops being a spiritual ordeal and it can become a technological flail where either family members or maybe a member of the medical team just won't give up, won't see the inevitable coming, and instead just pushes and pushes, which is very painful for the dying person, as well as depriving them of the opportunity to say their last blessings and to their final words.
That seems such an important part. You write about those last words, in a death like this in the past, a good death, they were often marked by those last words. You were
exactly.
Lucid. You were aware, at least.
Yes. And people were strangely in command. I mean, I've read, I'm a sort of an over-researcher, so I learned a lot more than I needed to write this book. But I was reading an account of a peasant woman dying in France in, I think, the 1600s. And it was like the people in her family said, well, should we call for the priest? No, no, don't call for the priest. Not now. Tomorrow, call for the priest. I mean, people said, I know I'm dying, which actually my own mother did say to me as well, that people intuitively, they hadn't turned over so much control and awe to something like a medical system. And so I think people were in some ways more self-confident. A strange thing to say, but on their own deathbeds, they were actually sometimes more self-confident than we are now.
You say that you and your mother at that time craved the sacred, but you did not know how to bring it to your father's deathbed. I wanted to ask you about something you write in the book, which you sort of describe this as the limit of your belief in eternal life, that at that time you didn't really draw any comfort from the spiritual beliefs of your upbringing, you know, Christianity, and the spiritual belief that you came to connect to, Buddhism. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Wow. These are tender spots, and I don't want to offend everyone. But for me, the fact is that when we die, we leave this world. I'm never again going to get a phone call from my mother. I'm never again going to be able to call her up and say, how do I get a spot out of my skirt? I'm not going to ever be able to hold my father again. And I think our religions have created comforting legends for what's going to happen later, that we are going to see them again. But for me and for my mother, that didn't really cut much ice with us and didn't actually comfort us. I just don't have that belief. I did get comfort after her death, feeling visited by her in a curious way.
Yeah.
But not in the way, I don't expect to be reunited with her again somewhere. I just don't. And I hope this is not offensive for me to say to your audience, because I know probably the majority of the world believes that there is an afterlife of some kind.
I did find it interesting that you did allow an Episcopalian chaplain.
Oh, yeah.
To give your father the last rites.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I'm a flawed human being, and there's no consistency in who I am. And that's, you know, that passage that we read earlier where I talk about the fact that I went shopping during the course of my father's death watch. I put that in there because I think we're all flawed human beings, mm-hmm. and there's no consistency to what most of us do. And I wanted to make it clear in the book that we were not idealized people who did a perfect death or something, because I don't want people feeling bad for their own limitations when they go through this grueling, harrowing final period of life. So what happened was I was sitting there holding my father's hand. This Episcopalian chaplain, who was a beautiful woman, came in. And I actually asked her to give my father his last rites. He had been raised as an Episcopalian, although he had drifted away, and he was an agnostic. But I got tremendous comfort from feeling that I was in some way turning my father's soul over to the benign forces of the universe, mm-hmm. and that we were marking this intense passage of life and death in this sacred ceremonial way, mm-hmm. using language that goes back again to the 1600s. There was something very comforting of knowing that you're part of a ritual that your people, however you define your people, have practiced for generations and generations. I think it's a way of saying, I'm not alone in this. This painful struggle to let go that my father's undergoing and I'm undergoing. Generations and generations of people have gone through this transition, and they have found sacred ways to mark these transformations that are meaningful, whether it's, you know, bar mitzvah or christening or weddings or funerals and this passage out of life. I'm a deep believer in our need for sacredness, even though I'm kind of a freelance sacred person.
Yeah. But you know, why does it matter? You know, why does it matter whether or not you will? I mean, the idea, it seems like there's this moment where you talk about later where you and your brothers are sitting there in silence at your father's deathbed. His body is there. Yeah. And you say you read no poems, you said no prayers, and then you pick up your cell phone and you know,
terrible.
And but you talk about the moment as you didn't know enough to make that moment sacred, that you were, as you put it this way, you were bereft of forms that could have told you what to do or say. That's what you were looking for, I guess.
Absolutely. And I guess that's, again, why I think it's so important for people to, you know, whether you go to one of these meetings of Death Cafe that are springing up around the country, or you sign on to the Conversation Project, or you just sit around after Thanksgiving dinner with the people you love and talk about what kind of music you'd like to have play at your funeral, or who would you like to have around you at your deathbed? What do you want to hear from people? Because I think we need to start laying this out, because you're sort of struck dumb in the moment. And people sometimes refer to their very best natures at those moments, and sometimes they resort to their worst natures. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a throw of the dice what's going to happen. So I think the more we can think this through. Now, since I wrote the book, I've become friends with a palliative care doctor, young palliative care doctor, and she will read, if someone dies in the hospital, essentially friendless and alone, she will gather her medical team around the bed, and she will read a beautiful poem by someone like Mary Oliver. You know, a poem that has sacredness and nature, but doesn't address any particular spiritual tradition. Mm. So she will make that moment holy, even in this very, very secular context of dying in a hospital. And so I feel I've learned since the book, I've learned a lot more. And I think that paragraph in my book is a cautionary tale for everyone else. It's like, don't let this happen to you. The dying will come. You may not know if it's going to be this week or next month or even a year from now. But imagine that moment ahead of time, and imagine what might comfort and reassure you and be meaningful to the people in your family who are around the deathbed in that situation.
Your mother, as you write, made plans for her life after your father. Yes. A lot of great plans, I have to say. I mean, it was a relief for sure, but it wasn't long, of course.
Yeah.
Before she was forced to confront her own end. I mean, death. It was her, you know, her heart valves. And she was told, there's this moment where you tell the story about the surgeon who was very matter of fact about the fact that, look, you've got to get your heart valves replaced. Kind of like spark plugs, you know. It seemed so kind of very matter of fact about it. And but your mother had learned these lessons by this point. And at this point, you talk about how she had she was no longer a trusting and deferential patient, is how you put it.
Yeah. Yes. She made plans to get a cat. Yeah. She made plans to even visit South Africa, her birthplace. And then she realized she was just too sick to do it. And when she had been a trusting and deferential patient when my father got that pacemaker, and she had become a question asker. And she was going to make her own decisions, thank you very much. And she was no longer cowed or impressed by anybody's long string of initials after their name. And the doctor was very forthright and said, with the surgery, you could live to be 90. Mm-hmm. Without it, you have a 50-50 chance of dying within 2 years. And he was so obviously not sympathetic. I mean, she said to him, if I have a stroke, I want you to let me go.
Yeah.
And he said to her, I will not operate with your DNR, your do not resuscitate order, in place. And what about just a minor stroke, a little weakness on one side? And that was not the answer that a woman who had spent 6.5 years taking care of someone with terrible stroke damage wanted to hear. I think she was much more eager to not go through what my father went through than to gain a few extra years of life.
Mm.
And so she came out of an echocardiogram and she just looked at me straight in the eye and she said, I will not do it. And my mother was very decisive. I mean, I think they say people die the way they lived. And she was just the same way she was decisive to a fault about putting the pacemaker in. She was absolutely decisive about this. And 5 different cardiology teams tried to get her to change her mind in the course of the next 5 months. And she beat them all off with sticks with my help, I will say.
Right.
And I mean, I even got to the point where I called her the family doctor and I said, look, you know, should she change her mind? Maybe the doctors are right and she's wrong. And he said she doesn't want to risk ending up in a nursing home, and I would make the same decision if it was my mom. So he really backed her up. You know, having a family doctor who deeply knows you and loves you and that you trust and knows your values, it's night and day dealing with someone like a family doctor who knows you and dealing with a cardiologist who met you twice for 15 minutes. Mm. They just don't know who you are. So she was, I mean, it's almost frightening and awe-inspiring when I think about how she handled herself in the last 5 months of her life.
Resolute.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. There's also a moment here that, like almost everything in this story, complicates it just a bit because you say there is it seems as though there's this moment of doubt because you say to her at one point, in a tone I take it you may regret a little bit later, that you say, Mom, we're grasping at straws here.
Yeah.
And she's
I don't regret saying it.
You don't?
I don't regret saying it, and I don't regret how I said it.
Yeah.
It needed to be said,
right.
And it was the loving thing to say. It was loving, and it was realistic.
Yeah.
And love can, it's like what I read earlier about love can look heartless. I have no regrets about it because a month or two earlier, I had said to her, are you sure?
Right.
The surgeon says you could live to be 90. And she said, I don't want to live to be 90.
Right.
But I think it raises that issue that you raised earlier, which is that it's easy in the calm of looking forward to say, oh, I don't want to die plugged into machines. But then when your mortality stares you in the face, it's very frightening. And especially if you live in a culture that has no map for what you're going to go through, where you don't have someone saying to you, I am your doctor and I will be with you and be with your family throughout the dying process. You don't have someone saying that. Instead, you have someone saying, well, we could do a third or fourth round of chemo here, and I'll be with you through the chemo.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. We don't, I did a lot of research for the book, as I said, but one of the things I read was one of the purposes of religion is to guide the living through the experience of death. And I think our religions can help us, guide us, both the living and the dying, through the experience of death. And that there are ways we can be reassured, like, I'm going to be with you till you die. I'm going to make sure that you're comfortable. I'm going to make sure that your family's distress is taken seriously, and we're going to give them attention too. I don't think people would be so terrified. And, you know, some people, you're right, at the last minute they say, oh, give me that open heart surgery after all. And now it's kind of too late because they're too weak. But a lot of people don't do that. They want reassurance. They want to be held by a loving community. And if we don't offer them that, and the only thing we offer them is more surgery, more chemo, more whatever, which isn't working anymore, some people will take that path. And you're right, because at that moment, my mother, you know, she'd been offered stents, and they were saying, well, maybe we could do stents, and stents could relieve your heart pain. And she didn't want to die. She was a very vigorous woman. But we were grasping at straws, because I later researched it, and it turned out that 40% of the people who get surgery when they were as bad off as she was after that first heart attack, 40% don't leave the hospital. 40% die within a month of the surgery. So her odds at that point were extremely poor if we had gone into full tilt boogie mode. And there's a very good chance she would have died in intensive care, because where are we going to stop if we don't, you know? And plus, she'd been so clear. And so if someone's been clear for months, and then at the last minute they're starting to say, well, let's try this, let's try that, I think it's time for the harsh kindness of what I did, which is to say, I think we're grasping at straws now. And, and we were.
And
we were.
And she never turns back from that resolution, but she does say, it's hard to give up hope.
Yes. Yes. And that's the truth. It's hard to give up hope. Just like it was hard for those people in the 1450s. You know, when they talked about it as a temptation to sin, that it was hard to say goodbye to your house and your castle and your land and to your family and the people you loved. Of course it's hard.
Katie Butler is with us. Her book is Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Katie Butler. We're talking about her book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. So you have regret about not going. You had this sense early on, and I don't want to spend too much time with this because I expect it might be almost in some ways too painful to talk about. It must have been really difficult to write about this moment you had, the sense in your heart that you should have gone to see your mother. You want to say something about that?
Yeah. And I wrote all the details because I didn't want other people to feel inadequate because of how they go through the deaths of people they love. There's no way to do this perfectly. And there's no way to predict what's going to happen. And in my case, I somehow assumed that my mother's death would be like my dad's. I mean, my dad took 6.5 years to die. And my mother was healthy as a horse and, you know, more vital in her 70s than I was in my 50s. And so I thought if she had a 50-50 chance of dying within 2 years, she would definitely at least hit the 2-year mark, if not a whole lot more. And, well, to tell you the honest truth, my relationship with her was much more difficult than my relationship with my dad. You know, she and I were like oil and water in some ways. You know, she was the uber housewife and I was sort of the scatterbrained, you know, freelance writer on the West Coast. Right. And so we didn't have the ease in our relationship that I had with my dad. And I'm sure that played into it. I was in some ways afraid of her. And I was also eager to have my brothers share the burden of caregiving. And so after she had her first heart attack, one brother went out for a week. And then the second brother went out, and I was to go out third, sort of in rotation, because we all lived in California. And I'll probably regret forever that I didn't, like, put aside my work and insist that my brother move aside and show up for her, because she needed me. And she needed we in ways that my brothers were just incapable of really coming through. And so I still cry about the fact that she had spent so many years caregiving my dad so well. And then at the end, she was one more widow living alone, like so many widows at the end of their lives, trying to make do with little bits of help here and there, and me not being there. It just feels awful. And there was even a moment, you know, a very kind of moment of grace about a week before she died, when I was like having breakfast in the garden, and I just felt almost like a voice say to me, "Your mother is dying. This is a sacred time." And for a moment, I was willing to put everything aside and get on a plane. And then I got a call from the brother who was taking care of her at that time. And he said, "Don't come yet. I want more time with her. I have things to work out with her." And I, you know, I basically rolled over, and I'm sorry now. I think we want to be with the people we love when they die, you know?
Yeah. You have regrets about that, of course. But it's so interesting to compare the death of your father and your mother. The contrast is extraordinary. That makes the point really in of itself, because your mother died, as you put it in this section. I want to have you read this part, if you don't mind.
Sure.
She was lucid. It was painful and messy and imperfect. But as you say in this section, she took her body back from her doctors. Would you read this section for us?
Sure. Okay. Ehe Dogen, the great Buddhist teacher who revitalized Zen in Japan in the 12th century, had these words to say about dying. "In birth, there is nothing but birth, and in death, there is nothing but death. Accordingly, when birth comes, become and manifest birth. And when death comes, become and manifest death. Do not avoid them or desire them." My mother died like that. She told the hospice nurses that she wanted to stop eating and drinking, that she wanted to die and never go home. Her heart management nurse stopped by her bed and said she hoped this was just a bump in the road. My mother said, "It feels like an avalanche." She took off her hammered silver earrings and said, "I want to get rid of all the garbage." She told my brother Michael to call Jonathan and me. By the time he came back from the phone, she was dead. He broke into sobs. It could have been too much self-administered morphine or too little potassium. It could have been the stress of the cardiac catheterization. It could have been getting up and walking and making martinis for people who stopped by to see her. In the end, does it matter? She died of old age, sickness, and death. She died of a heart calcified and broken by 6 years of nonstop caregiving. She died of being 84. She was continent and lucid to her end. She took back her body from her doctors. She died the death she chose, not the death they had in mind. She reclaimed her moral authority from the broken medical system that had held her husband hostage. She died like a warrior. Her dying was painful, messy, and imperfect. But that is the uncontrollable nature of dying. She faced it head on. My brother Jonathan called it a triumph.
You write in the book that you sense this open rebellion, as you put it, occurring by families like yours, who are reclaiming death from medicine. And you say it's much like the natural childbirth movement that emerged in the 1970s. You're seeing this movement growing, are you?
I think it's growing huge, and it's both inside and outside medicine. So I could not even count the number of emails that I've gotten from people who said, we regret that we allowed that hip replacement surgery that was followed by dementia. We regret that we got intimidated and put in a feeding tube that was created more havoc and pain than it was worth. There is a level of outrage and bewilderment out there. I think medicine risks reaping the whirlwind. And at the same time, there's also a growing counter-movement within medicine. It's the palliative care doctors. It's the internal medicine doctors. It's a lot of the critical care doctors who run intensive care units who see this unnecessary suffering because you have disagreement in a family or disagreement on a medical team. So I think sometimes it's called the slow medicine movement, which really just means quality over quantity and slow the decision-making process down. Don't assume that more is always better because sometimes more means worse. So I see it bubbling both inside medicine and outside medicine. And I think the great healing for me in writing the book is understanding how many doctors love this book and are sympathetic to this book and ask me to come and speak at their medical schools because I'm giving voice to something that within medicine they may not be able to give voice to quite as bluntly as I can because they have to work in these systems and get along with all these different departments, the cardiologists, the cancer doctors, everybody. But I can come in and speak very, very openly about the toll of suffering that is occurring for families and that we don't always want so-called everything, which really means the wrong things,
right,
to be done.
Is that what you mean by that we need to learn to honor the compassionate impulses of doctors and nurses?
Yes. Yeah. Which means giving them some time.
Yeah.
Everything is such a factory assembly line where people are getting, they're throwing tests, procedures at people very, very rapidly without knowing the family or the person. We need to honor them and pay them much, much better for time than we pay them for technology. Because sometimes the healing force in medicine is trust, it's talk, it's time. It's not tests, it's not procedures, it's not high tech. And we need to do a switcheroo and kind of turn the system of value upside down. I'm talking about the end of life.
Yes.
For the older person, obviously, you're young and in a terrible car crash. You want all the fast medicine you can get. But, 85% of our medical budget is Medicare. So a huge proportion of medical procedures are occurring in people in their older years. And I have great hope that this is changing because I see people one by one taking back their authority, knowing what to say. I mean, a lot of this is knowing to say, please give me a palliative care consultation. Please bring in the palliative care doctors because those are the ones that share these values of slow it down. Let's do what really helps quality of life rather than quantity. So just knowing to say that or knowing to say, I want a bioethics consult or I want to give my mother comfort care only. People are learning and becoming more sophisticated about how to interface. And a lot of this is to reassure the medical system that you're not going to go out later when your mother has died and sue and say that she was neglected because she didn't get that open heart surgery. Mm. So I think there's a vast process of cultural education going on right now outside medicine. And they're also growing counterculture within medicine that is trying to change things from the inside. There's this, I don't know if you have it in Utah, but there's this whole movement called Death Cafe. And the only rules of Death Cafe is that you come together in a group, random people, just advertise it on the internet. And the only rules are coffee, tea, and cake. You have to serve cake and you have to talk about death. Mm. And that's it. And people go in scores to these things because there's such a silence surrounding this. And people know that I consider that we have an epidemic of unnecessary suffering occurring on the way to the deathbed now. And that if we name it and claim it, we can change it. But if we don't name it, we're powerless. We're subjected to whatever random forces hit us. So,
Katie Butler, Her book is Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Katie Butler, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much, Doug. That was a wonderful hour. You're very probing but sensitive, and I really appreciate that combination.
Thanks very much. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Michael Havey. Our theme music is composed by The Moth and the Flame. Michael Shea is our intern. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.